Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, and welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys. I want to thank you so much for tuning in. You can follow me on Twitter, at Joy Keys. Also, check me out on Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys, and on Instagram, Saturdays with Joy Keys. You know, I do a lot of giveaways, so I encourage you to follow. I'll be giving away a book this weekend, so definitely follow. Also, you can check us out on Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, as well as here at Blog Talk Radio. I thank you so much for supporting the show and sharing with friends and family. I hope they were helpful and you learned a lot of information. Well, this morning I have the honor of speaking with a Pulitzer Prize winner, a National Book Award winner, a historian, a professor. She's from Texas, and she wrote a book about Juneteenth. It's called On Juneteenth, and we're going to talk about that today. Good morning, Annette Gordon-Reed.
Good morning to you.
Thank you again for agreeing to come on the show. You have so much knowledge to share, and you're debunking a lot of myths that are making people feel uncomfortable again. This is like, what is this now? You know, people are like, I'm not liking this lady. She's talking about somebody's in love with somebody across the color lines. And, you know, black people are able to speak French. And what in the world? So you are from Texas, yes?
Yes, I am.
And you're from Conroy, Texas. And that has a deep history. We'll talk about that a little bit. Tell me a little bit about growing up there. What were some of your favorite things to do as a young child?
Well, as a kid, it was a typical kind of small town, riding my bike, playing baseball with the, you know, with the people in the neighborhood, running around, just having, you know, freedom that my kids who grew up in Manhattan have not had, obviously. So I enjoyed being around my family. We were close to my grandparents and my cousins and so forth. So I remember a kind of easy existence in the country, pretty much.
Now, do you remember having a deal with racism? I know you went to a school and you were like the only black child there. Can you tell us a little bit about that at Anderson, I think the name was?
I went to first grade about 10 years after Brown versus Board of Education, and the school districts in the South were being really recalcitrant. They were coming up with all these ways to, you know, to avoid Brown in integration. And in my hometown, they came up with, and in Texas and other parts, something called a freedom of choice plan, where you were supposed to, white people were supposed to pick white schools and black people were supposed to pick black schools. My parents decided to send me to a white school to integrate the schools of my town. So, yes, I was there, you know, as a six-year-old, the only black kid in the school and in the town in a white school, and it was kind of tough. I mean, my teachers were wonderful to me. They were very, very supportive, but some of the kids were nice and some weren't. And it was a very, very intense experience, I should say. I grew up, you know, in a place that was still, you know, segregated in ways. When we went to the doctor, there was a separate waiting room for white people and black people. When we went to the movies, we had to sit in the balcony. Black people sat in the balcony. And so that was my earliest, you know, as a 4- and 5-year-old and 6-year-old, those were my memories of what dealing with the white community was like. Remember I said before, I thought it was a happy childhood, but when I was in my community, in the black community with my family, it was wonderful, but there was always that tension with whites in the area.
What's this deal with the white milk? You drinking white milk. tell them a little bit about that story.
Oh, yeah.
That was really crazy.
This is a girl in my class who said to me one day after we got into an argument that I drank white milk instead of chocolate milk the way everybody else drank because I wanted to be white like her. And the reason is, of course, my mother just didn't think it made sense for me to be drinking chocolate milk every morning, you know, when you bring the milk truck around, that was too much. And it was just funny because this was somebody who had been somewhat friendly to me, but it kind of showed me that there was always the chance that even a white person who was a friend of mine at that time, if they got mad at you, race would come back into the picture, you know, that she was always thinking, you know, you would not know it on a day-to-day basis that she was thinking about race. But the moment we had an argument that all of a sudden it kind of came out and you're drinking white milk because you want to be white like me. And I was like, you crazy? I mean, what, in first place, it's a stupid idea. But second, why would you even think that I wanted to be white? And so she was thinking that she was special because of that. And I wanted to be like her. So it was really crazy, stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, your parents, the way you described them, really gave you a backbone of confidence, I feel, and to deal with these things. And some of them were harsher than others. I mean, you did get a little violence enacted on you. The boy punched you in the chest. You know,
this is sort of the part about integration that we don't talk about very much, and that is that there were members in the black community who felt that they lost something, and they did lose something, because when they integrated the schools, they took lots of the black teachers out of the classrooms. So black kids lost role models, and white kids lost the opportunity to have black teachers as role models. My mother remained in the classroom. She was an English teacher. But I was standing in line one day, and a black kid who knew who I was, and I think blamed me for integration into town, just started punching me in the chest, you know, because he was, I didn't know who he was, you know, I didn't know his name or anything like that, but I understood what he was upset about. And it was the court that ordered desegregation eventually, that struck down, the Supreme Court struck down these freedom of choice plans, and then everybody had to integrate. But he saw me, he knew that I was the first person to have, you know, ventured into this, into a white school, and he blamed me for this. And so, yeah, so there was tension from white people, and there was tension from some black people. Other black people were supportive, but there were, I understood why, you know, I understand now why, I don't understand why you would hit me, but I understand why they were angry, because they loved their school. Booker T. Washington, which was the school, was the center of the black community there, and the teachers were role models. People looked up to them, and then when they brought the kids together, but they were not willing to fully integrate teachers into positions of power and administration in the school district.
Yeah, you discussed about the relationship that black children have with their black teachers is different than the relationship you had with your white teachers. And I guess I can relate to that because I went to one school that was mostly black, and then I had to go a couple times a week for a gifted program, and it was mostly white. And there is a different, just a different feeling. You can't like really, I don't know how to say it, but I had an eighth grade teacher. She was black, and she was teaching us Swahili. It was just this energy with her, you know, it was this like real connection. And then I had another teacher. She was a music teacher. She was white, great teacher. But it was just not the same thing as this black woman who was teaching me Swahili, you know. Go ahead.
No, yeah. I mean, you're right. I mean, my mother said to me, my parents became a somewhat disillusioned with integration as they saw how it had played out. And she said she loved all of her students, black and white. You know, she loved them and loved teaching. But she said she went to Spelman, and then she went to TSU for a master's program, and then got married. She had us, and then didn't continue with it. But she said she'd gone to school to become a teacher to teach black students. That she was part of that generation of people who thought about uplift the race, you know, that they were supposed to be, you know, that everybody was supposed to be making a contribution to the black struggle, and this was going to be hers. And so when she ended up teaching in the high school, she had wonderful students. And one of the great things about having written this book is that I've heard from a number of them, black and white, about what she meant to them. But she said, you know, we couldn't talk to black students the way they did when they were at Washington. They'd say, you know, it was not just reading, writing, and arithmetic. It was, you know, you have to do these things because our people are, you know, on the move and we're going forward. And I mean, it was, they could, that energy that you're talking about could be there because there was a larger purpose to it as well. Well, she didn't have to exhort white kids like that because the society was made for them. I mean, she influenced them individually, but it wasn't a, you know what I mean? It wasn't like a group thing. That reason for exhorting people forward. So, you know, she had to find a different mission, and she continued to love teaching. And as I said, the students loved her as well, but that's not why, what she thought she was going to be doing when she went to college and went to, you know, graduate school to become a teacher.
Now, one of the things I learned in reading your book, very simple, kind of just a childlike amazement, Six Flags, Texas, and the Six Flags and the amusement park. Tell the audience a little bit, what does that mean, Six Flags in relation to Texas?
Well, Six Flags refers to the six flags that flew over Texas over the course of its history. You know, we have Spain and you have France, we have the Confederate. It has every nation that had some interest in Texas. And the amusement park originally started out with areas that were supposed to represent the time period when it was under Spanish influence, when it's under the Confederacy even. You know, the Confederate flag flew over it as well, the American flag. And so when it goes out to other places, there may not have been Six Flags in New Jersey. Oh, you know, in other places where the theme park exists, but it started right outside of Dallas when I was a little girl, and I talk in the book about taking a trip there, the first trip to Six Flags, which was a big deal to us when we were little kids. And
now,
it was called Six Flags Over Texas, and every time somebody says Six Flags, in my mind, I always say Over Texas.
Right. You say that in the book, like, you guys are doing something here.
Yeah.
Now, there are other people that lived in Texas before you, and you talk about the history of other Africans, African Americans that lived there. One of the people that lived in your town was Bob White. Tell the audience about who Bob White was and his story.
Well, Bob White, this is a story that I first heard from my grandfather when I was a little girl. Bob White was a black man who had been born in Livingston. I was born in Livingston, Texas myself, and then moved to Conroe as an infant. But we would visit my grandparents in Livingston, and he told me about Bob White. Bob White was a man accused of having raped a white woman and was sentenced to death, sentenced to the electric chair, and back in the days when you could do that. And his case, and I didn't know this until I was working on the book, his case went all the way up to the Supreme Court because while he was in jail, the Texas Rangers would take him out of the jail at night, take him out into the woods, tie him to a tree, and beat him until he confessed. Mm-hmm. And so this question of, you know, due process, is it, can you do this, went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, no, you can't beat a confession out of somebody. That violates the due process clause. So they sent it back for a new trial. When they had the trial in my hometown, because they moved it from Livingston, they moved it to Conroe, when they had the trial, while he was in the courtroom, Ruby Cochran, the woman he was supposed to have raped, her husband came into the courtroom and walked up behind Bob White and shot him and killed him. And right there in front of everybody, from the judge, the jury, spectators, the police, everybody, and he hands the gun to the bailiff, and he's tried. And he's acquitted in about 3 or 4 minutes. And so this was a crushing, you know, lynching had happened in Conroe beforehand, but this was crushing in lots of ways because I think people had hoped, you know, with the case going up and getting a new trial, that there might, justice might be done. Mm-hmm. And what ends up happening is that he's killed and nothing happens to him. Now, the other thing my grandfather had told me back before I found out about this case, working on this book a long time ago as a little girl, actually, is that Ruby Cochran and Bob White were having an affair. And when it was discovered, it became a case. It was turned into a case of rape. He said that Bob White foolishly talked about this, you know, told people. He said, my grandfather said they were going together. That was the phrase he used. that they were going together, and people knew that. And then when her husband found out about it, it becomes a case of rape, and eventually he is killed in open courtroom, and nothing happens to the person who, with premeditation, murdered him in front of all these people here. So that's the kind of power that white men had in Conroe. They could walk into a courtroom and shoot somebody, and nothing would happen to them, you know, and
I mean, we have this
him.
Situation, we feel, many African-Americans, I don't know if you feel, to this day, somebody may not be getting shot in the court,
oh, yeah.
but they are getting
yeah.
killed by being put away for longer sentencing, you know, and nothing
is done. Or they're killed during arrest.
They're killed during arrest. So
police encounters.
Yes. There's a fear of this white power through the police. One of the things you mentioned in your book is the issue of patriarchy. And I love that you say it's something to the effect that patriarchy is not just against women in a sense, but it's also this like competition between males, and that
yes.
the white male is at the top or was at the top and policed in a sense, if you will, black men and their access to the type of women they could be with. They could be
oh,
with
yeah,
black
absolutely.
Women, but they couldn't be with anybody else. And so that
yeah,
was
another
form of policing, if you will.
And white men had access to black women, to white women,
yes.
to every kind of woman. But black men were, you know, restricted to black women. And, you know, that kind of policing isn't just in the past. Obviously, as you're saying, this kind of thing happens today as well.
Now, this book on Juneteenth, tell the audience, what is Juneteenth? Many people may not know what that is, even though we have a national holiday now. But
yeah, national holiday. Well, Juneteenth celebrates June 19th, 1865, when Gordon Granger goes to a general in the Union Army, goes to Galveston to take over Texas, the District of Texas, and he makes the announcement that slavery is now over in Texas. Now, a lot of people mistakenly think that black people in Texas, the enslaved in Texas, did not find out about the Emancipation Proclamation, which was signed 2 years before then, until Granger says this. They knew. But the problem was that the Confederate Army kept fighting. It surrendered. The Confederate Army in the area of Texas and the Southwest
mm-hmm.
surrendered at the beginning of June. They did not surrender until the beginning of June 1865. And once they did that, that's when Granger could go in and make this announcement. And it is a day that has been celebrated ever since then, even though in the immediate aftermath of the announcement, a number of white people in Texas reacted badly to this, obviously, the end of slavery, and they whipped people. They assaulted people sometimes for celebrating. But black Texans kept on celebrating, and for 156 years there have been celebrations of the day and commemorations of the day, whatever word you wish to use, recognition
mm-hmm.
of the day from that time period, even in the face of a lot of hostility.
Now, did they able to walk off the plantation? I mean, where would they go? How did they make money? They were free, but then what?
Well, they were freed not long after Granger makes this announcement. The Freedmen Bureau opens in Galveston, and Union soldiers, where the Union soldiers were, they were able to enforce contracts between the former enslaved and their enslavers. In places where they were not, there were a lot of people who were probably forced, you know, who were kept in bondage. In effect, you know, not legal bondage then, but, bondage because there were no soldiers or other people to defend them. But in most places in many of the places where there were black people in Texas are concentrated mainly in the eastern part of the state,
mm-hmm.
West Texas not so much. But where the Union Army was, they were able to enforce the end of slavery, and eventually Reconstruction starts and Texas, in order to come back into the Union, I mean, they abide by these rules, but it was tough going for people. They knew I mean, they celebrated the end of legalized slavery, but they understood, it's clear they understood that they had a battle ahead of them, and they did for many years. They're still battling now, as a matter of fact, when you think of voter suppression and all the things that are going on down there now. But it was a mix of celebration in the midst of a lot of hostility.
Now, some people got together and bought a park.
Yes, they did.
Men got together. Talk to them about this park and the meaning of it for African Americans in Texas.
Well, in 1876, four black men pooled their resources in Houston and bought land for the specific purpose of being able to celebrate Juneteenth. This is how important this was to them to do this, as I said, even in the face of a lot of hostility. And they called it Emancipation Park. It was first, it was not called Juneteenth at the beginning. That's something that came later. It was called Emancipation Day. So they had Emancipation Park, which is still there. I have been to Emancipation Park a couple of times to celebrate Juneteenth. It was my family. And it's a, I think, just a wonderful example of black resilience in the face of, as I said, hostility to purchase this land, something not just for them, but something that would be there for posterity. They're making a plan for the future. And the park has been there, and they have celebrations there, and I imagine it's going to be a big deal in 2022 when you have a celebration, the first one that we're able to do after it became a federal holiday. There was technically one this year, but I think people are going to do it out really well next year. And I'd actually like to go down there and see what it will be like.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully this COVID drama will have eased
up.
Oh,
let's hope so. Let's hope so.
And people can, you know, get back to being close together, literally, physically close, and have that energy, because there is a difference. I mean, if you talk to performers, music art musicians, there is this gap that they feel of not having the audience. So we as people need an audience, too. We cannot be on that island. Now, there was a way of celebrating Juneteenth. Some people used to eat goat, I think is what you wrote in the book.
Yes. I don't know where that came from, but that was a part of it. I have no idea where that came from, but that has been a part of the tradition. Our family wasn't big on that, but red soda water, which we drank as a little kid, you know, that's supposed to be a part of it, a red drink. And some people do red velvet cake. I think I read from a historian, a person who food historian who studies black folkway, said that hibiscus tea was what the original drink, which is red, people drank before. They obviously didn't have soda water, which we call soda water, soda pop. They didn't have that. And in my family, we had, because we're Texas, we had tamales. My grandmother made tamales, and that's a twist on all of it. Tamales are a holiday food in Texas and California, other places as well. So that became a part of our family tradition, is having now those as well. So, yeah, there's food associated with it. These get-togethers, typically at Emancipation Park, there were speeches and music, and obviously sometimes religious component to it as well, a prayer or whatever. But mostly, I remember throwing firecrackers, listening to music, and being with family. It's a family holiday, really. That's above all, and it makes sense because so many people were separated during slavery, and a lot of the black traditions and with family reunions and things like that, I think, are about this need to gather everybody up and be with the community. And this holiday exemplifies that.
Now, what do you see happening for yourself in the future? What is your next book going to be about? Are you going to write another book? Is it going to be controversial? Are you going to, you know, make people uncomfortable? Because we didn't even talk about the uncomfortable stuff yet, but they'll read about it in the book.
Well, I'm going to do another volume of the Hemings family story. The Hemings of Monticello was about Elizabeth Hemings and her family from, you know, the 1770s up until 1826, when they were all dispersed when Jefferson dies. I'm going to take the next generation of people and talk about them in the 19th century, during slavery and freedom and so forth. And so I'll be back to the Hemings family again.
Wow, that's going to be really interesting. I can't wait to read that. I definitely would love to have you back on once I read it, of course, and talk about that, because people are really itching to find out, you know, what happened. And, you know, you broke open, I guess, or broke down myths that people kept saying, oh, this was his mistress. Oh, she wasn't his mistress. That never happened.
That never happened.
mainly that never happened. You know, it's just crazy. Well, thank you so much. I'm just so honored to speak with you this morning about your book on Juneteenth. And I wish you much success with this book and also your future books. Thank you.
Thank you for having me on.
Okay, you have a great weekend, okay? Stay safe.
You too. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Thank you, everybody. I just got off the phone with Annette Gordon-Reed. She is a professor. She's a writer. She's a lawyer, a historian. I'm going to be giving away some copies of her book on Juneteenth, so you want to follow me at Joy Keys on Twitter. Also, check me out on Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. And also on Facebook, we don't just have a page. We have a group. And I find that people are getting the announcements faster on the group site. So it's the same name, Saturdays with Joy Keys group. And so check that out. And then also I'm on Instagram, Saturdays with Joy Keys. You can also email me, SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@hotmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. You can listen to the show on Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, iHeartRadio, as well as here at Blog Talk Radio. You guys have a great weekend. Stay tuned. I'm going to be talking about some guns.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is working to help keep you and your community safe from the threat of novel or new coronavirus. Take the following everyday steps to help avoid the spread of all respiratory viruses. Wash your hands often with soap and water for at least 20 seconds. Cover your cough or sneeze with a tissue. Throw the tissue away and then wash your hands. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects or surfaces, such as remote controls and doorknobs. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. And stay home if you are sick. Call your healthcare provider if you develop fever, cough, or difficulty breathing. For more tips, visit cdc.gov.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.